Barbarism, however bright its trappings, is still alien to her heart. Now remember that when we talk about history and Africa. Now here's my brief story or vignette of was inspired by this morning's session. It was in 1953 or 54. The place was Iambi in central Tanzania. A man from the Induguta village about 6 miles away had died. A friend of the family invited me to come to the death dance, which was to begin that night. So I went. It was dark, but the full moon was just beginning to share herself with us. From afar, we could hear that the professional mourners were hard at it. And when we entered the kraal, the place was already crowded with people. The mournful dirge of the Mbutu horns droned against the backdrop of the rhythmic beat of the drums. And I wondered where the woman, so recently widowed, was to appear. And then I looked up, and there she was on the flat roof of her Tembe house, silhouetted against the full moon. There she was, doing the common dance of humanity, shuffling across the roof to the universal beat of grief. What beauty and what sorrow melded into one picture. And I thought maybe God should bring in a cloud or two, so that nature might somehow accommodate the pain in her heart. And I realized anew how sorrow and grief so powerfully level us into the common humanity that we truly are. And so when we go on to talk about history, remember that history is about people. And people of all places, colors, religions, traditions are people. And we study and we learn about them to our own benefit. It's very easy for us to think of the continent of Africa only from the period of history in which we are involved. But it's good to be reminded that there have been 3 major attempts to establish Christianity in Africa. And the first attempt was very early. The first attempt to plant Christianity in Africa was in North Africa, in Egypt, and it lasted about 600 years. It must have been very early, for there are recorded martyrdoms as early as 185 AD. We don't know for sure where the first Christian witness came from, as far as North Africa is concerned, but we know that generally they were influenced by the North and the East. By the North, from Italy, Roman imperial power reached out and colonized North Africa, and they called North Africa the granary of Italy. They got a lot of their food from them. And then from the East, Palestine, Asia Minor, and so forth, traders traversed the Mediterranean and its coast, and they settled in North Africa. The map is kind of far away, but you have an idea of what we mean when we're talking about North Africa. North Africa is really, as far as the historians are concerned, everything from Egypt and to the left along the coast. And Egypt is considered by itself. But for us, it's also North Africa today. Some of the great names in our church history books come to us from this period of church history in North Africa. Augustine of Hippo, who was Bishop of Carthage, wrote The City of God, that marvelous attempt to picture in words what the kingdom of God means on earth. Cyprian, also a bishop. He was the first one, by the way, I think, to say there is no salvation outside of the church. And you know how many dialogues and books this has cost. What did he mean by church? What did he mean by salvation? What's the relation between the established church and the faith of people and all this? It goes on and on and on. And then there's Tertullian, very interesting character, who died a heretic. And he was the one who wrote this. He says, the more absurd it is, the more I believe it. And you can imagine the debate that this has caused over the lifelong theme of the relation between faith and reason. Fantastically interesting. Tertullian was the first who took Latin seriously as the language and the medium for the life of the church. And Tertullian was a lawyer. So much of the legal tone of early church documents, which have come right down to us today, come from Tertullian. In fact, Bishop Nigrin, in his book, Agape and Eros, I think that's his book, isn't it? Isn't that Nigrin? Yeah. The Swede. He says that we have Tertullian to blame for the fact that Roman theology developed so highly along legal lines rather than gospel lines. But anyway, Tertullian was one who lived and worked in North Africa. And then we have Origen of Egypt, the only true African among the bunch. He was truly a Copt, truly a native. The rest of them came along with thousands of other people who came and lived there for one reason or another, but Origen was Egyptian truly. Among other things, that he wrote an awful lot, you know. He hired how many secretaries, 80, 90 or something. He just kept busy copying all the time. He wrote this, among other things. He says, every people has their own Old Testament. Now, he didn't mean by that you shouldn't take the Old Testament seriously of the Scriptures, because without it, you'll not understand the New. But I found, as a missionary, this to be very true. Every person has their own Old Testament, every people. You learn the Old Testament so that you know what the New is saying, and because it has great truths of God to give us. But eventually, a people must meet God in the culture and the religion that is their own. And Origen did this greatly. Whether you believe that there is a preparatory work of the gospel in the traditional religion of people will depend on whether you take Henrik Kramer or Origen of Egypt as your model and mentor in your missiology. He, by the way, he also died a heretic. Those days they handed out heretic pronouncements with a little more ease than we do today. And maybe we can be thankful for that. But he was a great person. Now, regarding the demise of the church in North Africa, we can just say it very briefly. Because the church did die in North Africa. This now, for many years, for 1300 years probably, has been the voice of Islam. The church died in North Africa because of weakness from within and Islam's invasion from without, and both of them have to be considered. Muslims, I found out in East Africa, don't like you to say that North Africa was invaded by their armies, but still it's true. They can't change that part of their history. It's there. But the church was also weak. One weakness was that the church was too Latin, too much of a foreign imposition. Not just that missionaries came from Italy, that's not the point really, but large populations came from Italy. And they lived there, and they worshipped, and the church was strong among the Latin population, but very weak among the local Berbers. As far as we know, there was no significant Berber clergy, and we have no record of catechisms and hymn books and scriptures being translated in Berber languages in those early days. So it was weak. And when Roman power met up with Islam power, the people thought maybe the one is as good as the other, huh? Because they weren't too enthralled with the power that they had. Another weakness was dissension from within. The Donatist controversy was basically over the idea whether people who denied the faith under pressure could be forgiven. And the division took political lines. The Catholics who said, yes, they can be forgiven, became allied with Roman imperial power. And the others who said that they cannot be forgiven, they were united with all the power that was against colonial Rome. So the church was split on political lines, but it started with a theological argument. Huh? So when Islam came in great force, the people were not too unhappy to begin with. The Romans were defeated and they went home, and the Muslims passed many very strong discriminatory laws against Christians, both in Egypt and in North Africa, and eventually the church dwindled to nothing. And as I said, today it's the voice of Islam. Now, the second attempt to bring Christianity to Africa was in the 15th to the 17th centuries. And again, it came as a part of a colonial venture. But this time it was the Portuguese, and it happened in West Africa rather than in North Africa. In the area now called Angola and Mozambique, the Portuguese established their church. Obviously, this was the Roman Catholic Church. The Portuguese colonial efforts came as one enterprise with many departments. One of them was the Department of Religion, and then there were a number of other departments. Well, in the area now called Angola and Mozambique, they established a church, and they even sent Africans to Portugal for training as priests. But after about 200 years, Portuguese power waned, and her influence as a world power came to be very small. So the Portuguese went home and pretty much took the church with them. There wasn't very much that had really rooted among the people. A couple hundred years after this, when David Livingstone walked through those areas that we today call Mozambique and Angola, he noted two remnants of Christianity. First, a church building, which he said was used as a barn. And secondly, when the river oarsmen rowed him down the river, he said they sang a song in which the name of Mary was rhythmically repeated. So far for the first two great attempts to establish Christianity in Africa. It's kind of sobering, you know, to think that there was a good deal of effort, though it maybe was misdirected in some ways, yet the church never lasted in either one of these attempts. Now, the third attempt is the modern missionary movement, and it's usually what historians call everything from the 18th to the 20th century. The Protestant thrust came largely from the movement in 17th century Europe called Pietism. And it had its spin-offs in England and America. In Europe, the German Lutheran Pietists gave birth to the Moravian Church, which really were Lutherans with a mission emphasis. In England, it gave birth the pietistic influence came out in what they called the Evangelical Awakening, and that gave birth to a lot of missionary activity. And in America, the Great Awakening, and that also gave birth to a lot of missionary activity. For our point, what we want to remember about the pietists is that they believed in a church within the church, an awakened church within the established church. They didn't believe they should start new denominations, new churches. But we will be an awakened fellowship within the church. And they did this in many ways. They had their own university. They started little prayer groups all over. And people met to pray and to read and study the scriptures and start organizations which would take interest in the people in the world who did not know about Jesus Christ. So the second great emphasis of theirs was world missions. But remember this now, and this is one of the reasons that I thought that this is an important theme for us today. They believed in world missions as a church-directed program rather than a government-directed program. Now, we say, that's nothing. We've been doing that all along, but nobody had been up to this time. This must be seen against the medieval synthesis. They felt this coalition between church and state in medieval Europe was a mistake. So they said, the less you have to do with politics and economics, the better. And that, of course, gave them the name of quietists. You know, people who didn't involve them with government and economics. And for a reason, the pendulum was swinging. For years, any mission work that had been done by a colonial power as a part of a colonial venture, as a department of the government. And the Pietists were the first to cut the tie and say, this we will not allow, this will not happen. So I think we should not belittle them tremendously and use just derogatory terms about them, though they did bring a very quietistic emphasis to the church for a time. But we should remember that they get high marks for the tremendous step they took when they insisted on breaking the tie between colonial government and world missions. This took great insight and unusual determination. So in East Africa, the area we're interested in, this meant that Pietist mission societies, both of the Lutheran and the Moravian brand and so forth, and later of the English or the British, and later on Americans, but in the beginning German, came over and started mission work as a mission society. Berlin colonial power was just beginning in Tanzania about the time, or it was then called Tanganyika, about the time that the first German mission societies came, like Berlin I and Berlin II and Leipzig and Bethel, all those mission societies. And it's interesting that Berlin I was in Dar es Salaam area for a while, but they said, we can't be this close to our counterparts in German colonial power. So they moved from Dar es Salaam way inland. Huh? But of course, you never escape it too much. But they tried to stay as far away from them as they could. That's the first thing it meant. The second thing it meant was as little involvement with government and business as possible. They didn't want to partake in any commercial ventures to establish their missions economically. They said, we will do it alone. Like they told the King of Denmark when they went to their first mission in Trankobar, India, they said, no forced conversions. You know, he was the colonial power there, and he said, to get there, we had to go under his invitation. Huh? But they said, we're not a colonial mission. We didn't come under him. And they said, no colonial power can be used to force conversion. They said, what we will do is translate the scriptures and trust the Holy Spirit to create faith and start the church. And there started one of the major emphases of Protestant missions in the modern missionary movement, and that was wherever they went, one of the first things they did was translate the scriptures and the hymn books and the liturgies and so forth. So when you hear that modern missions was nothing but a religious obligato on the theme of colonialism, this is not quite right. Huh? It's true, we'll show how we got involved, but there was a great difference in the modern mission movement and its relation to colonialism as over against everything that had gone on before up to that time. there were some moderating factors now that made it difficult for them to stay as far away from colonial government as they wanted to. And the first one was the slave trade. They said, how could you not, some of them said after they got there, how can we not get involved with colonial government because we have to ask them to help us put pressure on the Arabs to stop the slave trade. See, in East Africa, it wasn't the British and the Portuguese and the French and whoever else was involved in the slave trade in West Africa. That had already stopped over there. This was the time when the British were, the early missions encouraged British colonial power to put all the pressure they could on stopping the slave trade. And in about 1870-something, 73, I think, the British started patrolling the Indian Ocean, this ocean to the right of East Africa. Huh? And they started catching slave ships that were taking slaves to Arabia and Persia and returning them to East African soil by force. And that didn't do quite enough, and they were still going on, so they put their naval big gunship right up along the coast of Zanzibar, that little island off of Dar es Salaam, and they aimed it right at the Sultan's headquarters. And he said, please sign this document that you will now stop the slave trade. Huh? And but for our purpose, this is what happened. When those people were dumped back on shore, what are you going to do with them? You got they're from all tribes all over in interior Africa. They were taken and didn't even know where they couldn't retrace their steps if they tried. Huh? They were a hodgepodge of different cultures and languages from Africa. And you couldn't put them back. So what the British government did then to the missions that were already there, and they were Anglican from England and Roman Catholic, mostly from France. And they said, we will pay you so much per person for the first year to feed them. And the Sultan will cooperate with us. Remember where the gun was aimed. Huh? The Sultan will cooperate with us in giving you land. So there came to be what they called freed slave settlements. And they were under the churches at the request of the British. So you see, this desire to be really apart from colonial power didn't go too well. But the British were not the colonial power there then. That wasn't true. They were simply trying to stop the slave trade at that time. Well, the first Christians in East Africa came from these settlements where they were taught. Where they were taught how to do various trades, better agriculture, how to read and write, and Christianity and everything. But it was a disadvantageous situation. First of all, it was an artificial situation. When Jesus said, make disciples of all nations, the Greek word is ta ethne, and for nations. And it doesn't really mean a nation like America and Canada and Germany, a political big nation like that. What it really means is any group with its own culture and language is a nation. Sort of the idea that if Christianity is going to take root, there's got to be a valid culture and language that you can go to. Huh? Well, here you had a rootless hodgepodge of people. They weren't even talking the same language, other than the fact many of them maybe were Bantu so they could begin to understand one another. But they certainly weren't united. And this was a disadvantage. And the early missionaries there said, this can't be the way we're going to do this. We'll help at this time, but it can't be right. If you have any doubts about that, go back in the archives of the CMS, for example, to England, and you'll see the letters and the decisions of the mission societies, how they tried to deal with this in other ways. The second disadvantage was that ordinary Africans who were living in these areas got the impression that they had to leave their society and move into an area governed by a missionary. He wasn't supposed to be a governor, but someone had to call the shots. Huh? And that, of course, was the opposite of what they wanted to be. So as soon as they could, they got out of these. But yet, history records that the first converts were here. So this is one of the moderating factors. Pietist societies did cooperate with colonial governments in the freed slave settlements. The second moderating factors had to do with the great need for education and medical work. And I'm not real ancient, but I even go back to that. We went to Africa in 52, and that's a long time after the beginnings of this stuff. But we still met this need for education and medicine in a powerful way. Let's go back a little bit. First century missions from Palestine to Asia Minor went from a lower developed society to a higher developed society. The missionaries who came from Palestine were poorer and less educated even perhaps than those who went to Asia, than the Asia Minor to whom they went. So that you don't hear in the New Testament about starting dispensaries and building roads and hospitals and schools, because they went there with the gospel. Those people already lived better than they lived back home. In fact, the pagan philosopher Celsus wrote to Origen, or he wrote to somebody, and Origen answered him. And he said, I accuse the missionaries of going to Asia Minor to get better food and finer beds. And Origen answered, and he said, it's true we get better food and finer beds when they go from Palestine to Asia Minor. But he said it wouldn't be worth the risk of death that always accompanies their efforts. So that isn't the reason they really went. Well, the opposite was true in East Africa. The opposite has been true of all modern missionary movement, that the missionaries and the mission thrust came from the more developed and the richer to the less developed and the poorer. Now, in Africa, that meant there was a tremendous need for education, a tremendous need for medicine. And even these pietistic missionaries who said, stay as far away from you can of extracurricular activities, even they said, we can't say we love these people in the name of Jesus without doing something for their education and for their medical needs. The first venture in education took the form of what came to be called bush schools. They were schools just dotted all over in the bush that taught reading, writing, arithmetic, and religion. They were a powerful way to penetrate Africa, because the Africans themselves then were the messengers. They were then the servants. The Africans taught other Africans. And this was going on yet when we came in 1952. Most of our work, the beginning years, had to do with these bush schools, where all around we had, I think, if I remember, 36 in our parish where we were, where they were teaching and preaching, and mainly through the school. So the school became a little worship center and a catechetical center and the reading of the three R's, teaching of the three R's. In 1924 and 25, a rich American by the name of Phelps Stokes gave a big gift of money for education in Africa. And the Americans turned it over to the International Missionary Council, and the International Missionary Council appointed a commission of a number of people to go all over Africa and assess the needs. That's where the famous Dr. Agri first came to be heard of a lot, from West Africa. That commission came to East Africa in 1924 and 25. They studied everything, and they said their report was to the International Missionary Council. And they said, first of all, thanks to the missions, the Roman Catholic and the Protestants that established schools, because they're the only one. The government wasn't doing anything. By that time, the British colonial government was there, but 1% of their budget was on education, and most of that was for their own kids, you know, the colonial children. Two, they said the education is too Western-oriented. You need more stuff written right in Africa. Well, that, no question about that. And then the third one, they said it doesn't go far enough. You can't prepare a people for independence with grade school education. And then the International Missionary Council took this and put it to the colonial government, the British Colonial Office in London. And surprisingly, they said, you're right. And now they turned around to the missions and said, will you help us? Because we can help with money, but we can't get people who are willing to go out and work like that. Well, you can. So there began that odd wedding between colonialism and pietistic oriented missions that lasted for about 30 years till colonialism became a swear word. And that's when we were there. When we tried to extricate ourselves from this relationship with the British in schools and so forth. I'm not sure we could have done anything else. We got out of that okay. In the end, they realized we weren't the same as the colonial power. But it's true that we did cooperate with them in education and medicine, mainly in education. They would often build the school, we would build the teachers' houses, and then they would pay the teachers, for example, out of the colonial funds and things like this. These schools in Independence were taken over, obviously, by the independent government completely, and the missions were just asked to come in and teach religion and so forth.